Stanley, this is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. When our guest today graduated from Dartmouth College 50 years ago, Vietnam was a small spot on the radar. They were aware some kind of U.S. military activity was going on there, but few thought it was something in which they'd be involved. In a few short years, however, 150 from the class of 64 would serve during the Vietnam War era, and now their experiences are compiled in a new book called Dartmouth Veterans, Vietnam Perspectives. It's the brainchild of Dartmouth grad Philip Schaefer, who, as secretary for the class of 64, was casting about for an idea for his column in the alumni magazine. He decided to talk with Vietnam veterans from his year and soon had so many stories, a column he felt wouldn't do them justice. And so the book includes all kinds of tales, from harrowing accounts of jungle battles to stateside desk duty to reflections on the war today. This hour on The Exchange, a unique look at Vietnam from Dartmouth veterans. Let's hear from you. If you or someone you're close to served in Vietnam, what goes through your mind when the war comes up? And even if you have no direct connection to it, how do you think the public views this war and its veterans today? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you like. NHPR Exchange, all one word. With us in studio is Phil Schaefer. As I said, he's a 1964 Dartmouth alumnus, editor of the book Dartmouth Veterans, Vietnam Perspectives. And Phil, congratulations on the book, and thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting us.
Also with us in studio, David Kruger, a Vietnam veteran and Dartmouth alum from Exeter, New Hampshire. And David Kruger, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
Also with us, David Hess, another Dartmouth veteran featured in the book, and a 12-term Republican state representative from Hooksett. David Hess served stateside during the war. And Representative Hess, welcome back. Always good to see you.
Always glad to be here, Laura.
And joining us from his home in Cleveland, Ohio, is Lee Chilcote. He served with the Marine captain in Vietnam. Again, another 64 Dartmouth grad. And Lee Chilcote, a real pleasure. Thank you for being with us.
Glad to be here, Laura.
Well, Phil, I want to start with you since you put this whole project together. What did doing this mean to you, to connect with these fellow 1964 graduates, to present their stories in a book to the wider world?
The purpose of the book was to bring back a group for our reunion, which is coming up in June. But it had actually many purposes. The reunion was just the main one. But the secondary purposes were to give these men an opportunity to write about their experiences. There are several projects in the country allowing veterans to write about their experiences. And in general, it's a positive opportunity for them and an experience which helps them with dealing with what they went through. And there are examples in the book of people who had a cathartic experience and have really improved their life. In fact, I got a very nice letter from the wife of one of the veterans who noticed an enormous improvement in her husband's psyche.
Really?
As a result of writing.
All these decades later, finally writing about it.
Absolutely.
What does that mean to you, Phil? You didn't serve. You graduated in 64 with these guys. And we should say Dartmouth was all male at that point, right?
It was.
So as we say guys and men, that's why. What did it mean to you as someone who did not serve?
Actually, I looked at it at the time as my service. I did not serve at the time. Looking at my own self, I would have thought I would not have been a good soldier. And I would probably, because of my major, been shipped off to do something about chemical warfare because I was a chemist. And I wouldn't have been particularly happy with that. So I finally found some way that I could serve not only these men, but history, I hope.
Well, and I want to get everybody else's thoughts on this question, obviously. But one more for you, Phil. What do you hope these stories add to the broader narrative, the broader public understanding of the Vietnam War?
With time, people gain perspective. And I think it's the perspective of these people that is important for the future. Realizing that almost all of the men were proud of what they did. Many of them were in favor of the war when they started. Few of them were as they left.
And that's definitely a thread in the book
that
we hear. And Lee Chilcote, I want to turn to you next. You know, before we get into some of the harrowing experiences you had, there's some spine-chilling tales in the book about what happened to you in Vietnam. Just more broadly, Lee, what did it mean to you to put this all down and have it published in Phil's book?
Well, I really hadn't ever spoken or written anything about my experience until 2012. And I went to Marine Week in Cleveland, Ohio, which was a show-and-tell or a goodwill tour by the Marine Corps. And I was just amazed at the strength and vitality of these young 25-year-olds. It was shortly after that that Phil contacted me and asked me to contribute to a column that he was putting in the Alumni Magazine. And I realized, you know, looking at those 25-year-olds, it's about time I say something about this war. So I did.
Wow, what
and
do
it was,
you
yeah. it was very meaningful to me.
Had you written it down before, Lee, or
I only had my diaries from the actual experiences in Vietnam, and I hadn't looked at those since 1968.
Wow. So how about you, David Kruger? What did it mean to you to put this all down on paper?
I think that I began to recognize what I had been through about 25 years after I had come back. Because in those 25 years, I refused to talk about it. I refused to go to any of the movies or see anything that had anything to do with it. It was a cathartic experience on the ground for a year in Vietnam. I made a turning point, I think, in 1988. I was then living in Hong Kong. I had the opportunity to be in one of the very first groups of Westerners allowed back into Vietnam.
Wow.
And went and found it. It changed my perspective, I think, on the entire experience. And now, rather than looking back, I can honestly say I look forward. And that I found, for me, very important.
Yeah, and you and David Hess before the show were comparing notes about how many times you've been back to Vietnam before. What was the click for you, though, David Kruger, when you had the opportunity to be one of the first to go back after kind of avoiding it for so long?
I had always confided in my wife and had said, even in 1967 when I came back, that I found the country physically to be absolutely beautiful. I had to admit I liked the people. But looking at the disaster that was befalling them, just put it out of sight, out of mind. I'll share with you one very brief thing on the way back, too. I did not experience shunning. I had a good return in 1967 for two reasons. One, I came back to the headquarters of the military complex in Washington, D.C., and the military complex was not the subject of the demonstrations. That was more political. And then when I got out of the Army a year later, I interviewed for a job in the only suit I owned, my captain's uniform. But I interviewed with seven Dartmouth alumni, all of whom, four of whom had been Navy carrier pilots in the Second World War, and I got the job.
Oh, there's that Dartmouth connection again that binds all of you. And David Hess, to you, and as I said in the introduction, you served stateside during the war. What did putting all this down in Phil's book, especially with the tales of people like David and Lee, what did that mean to you?
Well, first of all, Laura, I served 2 years at Clark in the Philippines. I was only 2 years in the States at Shaw in South Carolina. I was reassigned to Clark in the Philippines. Clark was the air hub of the entire war. And I had an accompany tour over there. My wife joined me 3 months after I got over. My oldest son was born there. But I spent time, a substantial amount of time in Thailand.
Got it.
I labeled my chapter as an Air Force JAG desk jockey, and that's what I was. I was a lawyer in the Air Force. But as a result of where I was and what I was doing, I had some very interesting experiences, including I defended probably the biggest American spy of the Vietnam War. among other things. So it's we had an interesting tour, totally unlike what Lee and David experienced. I like to call my wife and I white colonial imperialists of the 19th century vintage, because we had house girls, we had yard boys, we could go to the O Club and drink for 25 cents a beer, or et cetera. We could travel around the world, literally space available, free of charge, courtesy of the United States taxpayer, and got to see India, Nepal, Thailand, Macau, Hong Kong, Philippines, Taiwan, you name it.
Yeah, and people, when they think of the Vietnam War, Representative Hess, they don't think about legal work, but there was a lot of it.
Well, there was a lot of, you got to keep in mind too that what people call the tip of the spear, the combat forces, are really a very small fraction of the military. So David and Lee are among an elite small percentage. In fact, I had just asked Phil before we went on, did he do a tally as to how many of our essays were actually combat veterans and how many were rear echelon people like myself? I suspect it's probably around 10%.
Wow. Again, the number here in the exchange for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. We've got some callers calling in, gentlemen, and we'll take them in just a moment. Here's an email that just came in, though, from Jerry in Dover, and it relates to something you said earlier, Phil Schaefer. He says, I could not agree more with your guest. Most of us were in favor of the war when we arrived in the country, but were not after being there a while. The change in the attitude toward Vietnam vets cannot be shown more clearly, however, and the fact that there were just over 2 million who served in Vietnam. But according to the last census, more than 7 million now claim to have been there. That's amazing, Jerry. Thank you for that. What are your thoughts, Phil? I mean, without getting into the details of the numbers, this shift in attitude among veterans.
I think the shift is probably because we didn't know about what we were getting into. I mean, the people who were involved, the military people, we were just fresh out of college, green. There had not been a lot of discussion about this war going into it. It was something that we got into little by little, and it just expanded and blew up. When we were there on the ground and found out what was going on, that changed our opinions.
More on that after a break, and we'll hear from our veterans about that point, too. Thank you for the email, Jerry. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Facebook, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Post a comment there. Again, 1-800-892-6477.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. Make sure your membership gift to NHPR goes as far as it can with our corporate match program. Many businesses around the state match their employees' donations to NHPR. You can essentially double the impact of your membership gift. Find out if your company participates at nhpr.org. More on stories from the Vietnam War on the Exchange, then attend on the Diane Rehm Show the latest research on the causes and consequences of poverty in America. Mostly cloudy for today, showers likely, slight chance of thunderstorms this afternoon, highs mid-60s, lower 70s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Comcast Business, continuously investing to keep customers ahead of the technology curve. Comcast Business is built for business. More at business.comcast.com. And New Hampshire School Administrators Association, educational leaders recruiting individuals to serve children and communities. Job information at edjobsnh.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Dartmouth veterans of the Vietnam War. We're sitting down with the editor and several of the veterans featured in a new book called Dartmouth Veterans, Vietnam Perspectives. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. If you or someone you're close to served in Vietnam, what goes through your mind when this war comes up? Even if you don't have a direct connection with Vietnam, how do you think the public views this war and its veterans today, almost 50 years later? The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Phil Schaefer is editor of the book. Our veterans are David Krueger, David Hess, and Lee Chilcote. Again, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Gentlemen, before we go to our listeners again, I did want to ask you, Lee, and maybe you gentlemen in studio as well, but Lee, you first, please, this idea that when you first went over there, you thought, all right, this is good. I'm here to do a job, and I'm excited. And how did your feelings, what were your feelings at the beginning, Lee, and did they change over time?
I actually was very patriotic at the time. I think most of us were. And because I went in NROTC in 1960, I was very much committed to go to Vietnam. In fact, I in ROTC, I tried to finish first in my class so I could go to Vietnam. And actually, my attitudes did not change until many, many years later when I really learned the history of Vietnam. I really thought it was a good cause and thought our leaders were making pretty large mistakes in the way they were running things. But I was patriotic all the way.
All the way to when you got home. Can you talk a little bit more about that, Lee, please, that your attitudes changed later after you got back and had some time to settle in?
Well, what happened when I came home is the experience wasn't so good. The day I came home, a Marine was shot coming off a plane in Chicago, and I experienced some real negative feelings from people. I had no idea that that existed in this country at that point of time. It was March of 67 when I arrived at Coronado, California. And I buried most of my feelings for many, many years, but still found that people were very much opposed. And when I learned the history of Vietnam, I had studied history quite a bit, but I hadn't watched movies or read books at all until about 25, 30 years later. When I began to do that, I realized the folly of the war. And it wasn't until then that I did. I had kind of shut it out.
That must have been hard for you to process, though, Lee, because, you know, you served so bravely and, you know, you did so well and you know, were stood by your men and tried to protect them, and you saw so many things and you put yourself out there. So that must have been a really hard disconnect for you.
Well, time does wonders, and you gain perspective from history, and I think that's what did it for me. It's what began to create my interest in writing about this. I didn't think I could do it before that time.
You know, David Krueger, I got to ask you about this, too. This whole, that's another narrative from the Vietnam War, this less than illustrious homecoming, so to speak. Lee Chilcote tells us the day he got home, a fellow Marine was shot as he exited the plane. That's a terrible tale. How was your homecoming and sort of reprocessing in those early days?
As I said, mine was almost perfect. A loving family, welcomed back to New Hampshire, then to Washington, D.C. in the military complex and were shielded from it. And then employment by a militarily supportive organization.
Do you want to jump in, David Hess?
Well, I want to say a few things from my perspective. My homecoming was relatively placid and very nice. I came out in my Air Force uniform, was not the subject of any assaults or any negative reactions. I came back believing in the war as strongly as I had when I went on active duty in 1968. From a historical perspective, I think it's very interesting to note that Vietnam was just at that point in time the most recent manifestation of the containment policy that George Kennan had promulgated in World War II. We had successfully done it in Greece and in Turkey. We had successfully done it in Korea. And this was the next step where the communists were allegedly going to take over the world. And so the initial reaction, I think, was, well, this is just an extension of it.
Of a policy that had been successful.
Of a policy that had been successful and had been in place for 30 years. What really, I think, turned the war around was a couple of things. Number one, LBJ, whom I admired very much at the time, was very heavy-handed and didn't listen to any negative comments. Number two, Robert McNamara, while a great guy running Ford Motor Company, didn't know how to run a war. And number three, I think LBJ kept William Westmoreland in command far too long. He should have been dumped after a year. Tet Offensive was a horrible political event for us. It ended the war in terms of American commitment, but militarily, it was a rousing success. We basically destroyed the Vietnamese army during the Tet Offensive, and Creighton Abrams shortly took over command. And there's a lot of history that's been written that basically says if Creighton had been in command 2 years earlier, South Vietnam would still be a separate country.
Well, and I do need to turn to you too, Phil, again on this homecoming narrative. We're hearing several different stories just from our guests right here. What about the other people who contributed their essays to your book?
Okay, there's a very striking essay by, again, another lawyer who was on his way home to Alabama, and he was on a military transport, and most of the men on the transport were in stretchers. They were wounded being returned to a medical facility. And when they arrived, they were met by a crowd of protesters, and the man who was leading the protest had a megaphone, and the people in the crowd spat on the veterans who were coming off.
In stretchers.
In stretchers. And he said that seared into his mind, and he's always been appalled by that particular behavior, and he's still appalled by it.
I think it's important, Laura, to note that all of these negative things that happened were really not military people, so to speak, for the most part. I mean, Right. You had some people like John Kerry that were definitely anti-war. But most of the anti-war sentiment were political activists or kids in college and university that didn't want to get drafted, didn't want to go overseas. And it was part of the times with the race riots, with the riots in Chicago in 68. I mean, the 60s was a hell of a time in this country.
All right. Well, Phil, jump in, and then I do want to get our listeners involved.
It did change the society, though. That was the point. Those people had a big impact on how our society's developed.
Our phone number for you to join us with your questions, thoughts, stories, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. We're hearing stories from the Vietnam War from veterans of Dartmouth College's class of 1964. Their stories are compiled in a new book called Dartmouth Veterans, Vietnam Perspectives, edited by Philip Schaefer. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Jeffrey's been waiting in North Conway. Jeffrey, thank you for hanging on. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Thank you very much, and welcome home, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. I had two stories to relate to you. One happened recently, and one had to do with my homecoming back in April of 1967. And I know when we landed in California, we were giving a briefing that we have to wear our uniforms on the plane to get a military discount and to take a spare set of civilian clothes once we got on the plane to go to the men's room, to go to the lavatories and change into our civilian clothes directly because of the incident that the gentleman was talking about with the Marine, that people were actually getting assaulted when they got off planes with a military uniform. So I did go ahead and do that just to compile with it. But,
how did you feel about that, Jeffrey? I mean, you put your life on the line, and now you have to change clothes to show that you didn't do that?
I didn't have any feelings about it at the time. I was just so happy to get home alive. I was wounded while I was over there. I spent some time in the military hospital in Vietnam, but I was cleared to return to duty, and I guess I would do whatever I would have to do. But I think part of the problem back then is that you did come back as a unit. You came back as an individual. You served 365 days in Vietnam, and you kept the calendar, short-timer's calendar. And when your time is up, they put you on a helicopter. You went down to Thompson Air Base, and you flew home as an individual. You didn't have the support of your comrades that we're seeing now, where whole units go over and deploy at a time, and they're coming back.
Yeah, it does strike me as a little odd that you sort of flew commercial solo back home. That is a little odd.
Yeah, back then that's what they were doing. And to tell you the truth, it was one of those big Boeing airplanes, and there were 250 of us, and they had commercial stewardesses on board at the time, females, and we hadn't seen a woman in a year, so they took a lot of harassment on the way back.
Well, Jeffrey, you said you had another thought to share with us. Go ahead.
Yeah, I recently returned from Phoenix, Arizona. I was on a 7-day backpacking trip into the canyon of the Grand Canyon, and there were four of us there, five including me. And one of the gentlemen, after we started talking, he had asked me about my experiences and so forth, and I had told him, and he was quiet for a couple of days. He was an attorney from the state of Washington. Finally, about the fifth day, he said, you know, something's been gnawing at me, and I just want to relate this to you. He was a war protester during the Vietnam War in 1967. And I said, okay, we talked about it for a while. And he said, well, he has to go a little further. He actually went to Hanoi and protested in Hanoi against the Americans. They told him they thought that was interesting, that while I was fighting for my country, he was in Hanoi protesting against my country. He had asked me how I felt about that. I said, well, I said, I'm really proud to say that I gave you the opportunity to go over there. I said, as an American, you had that right. You have the right to free speech. I said, imagine for a minute that you were in North Vietnam and you were 19 years old and you left North Vietnam to go to the United States to protest. I said, you would have never been welcomed back in the country, or else you would have been imprisoned, you know, probably for life.
Jeffrey, that's an incredible story.
Yeah, and I had to spend a week with this guy, and as I said, I had no hard feelings. It was his right, and that's what I fought for.
Thank you so much for joining us. We really, really appreciate it. And Lee Chilcote, I'm going to go to you first, but I think everybody wants to jump in on some of the themes that Jeffrey raises. And Jeffrey, thank you so much. Lee, what comes up for you from this phone call from Jeffrey?
Well, what comes up to me is going back to 1968. I served in the 1967 Tet Offensive. People have kind of forgotten that. 1968 was the iconic moment of the war. It was the Marine Corps' finest hour, and they were most successful in that phase of the war. And how ironic it was that that was the height of the protest at the same time. Because it is true that we could have been successful if the right people had been in charge. Not that the war was necessarily the right one, but we could have been successful. And it seemed like it seemed to me at the time like a huge waste of human life to allow that to get away.
Two other things that come up from Jeffrey's call, and maybe I'll turn to you first, David Krueger. This idea about how he was re-entered into this country seems like they do it a lot better today.
I do believe they do, in part because the political turmoil around Iraq and Afghanistan is very different than the turmoil around that was during Vietnam. I think the press, I think, has done a better job of welcoming the people back. The press got on the bandwagon of the protests more than they did on those of us that were there in the 60s and early 70s.
What do you make of his story about, you know, he's on this Grand Canyon hike and turns out one of the people on this in the small group was a very strong anti-Vietnam protester? It's a nice reconciliation story, isn't it?
And one that I would have hoped that I would have had the presence of mind to have done. I found that to be extraordinarily well done.
David Hess, you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I want to jump in on two things. Number one, in terms of troops flying back and forth commercially, you got to remember that we are moving 500,000 troops a year to and from Vietnam, 1 million a year. They all flew charter aircraft, commercial aircraft, and they all flew individually. So that is one thing that is correct. The other thing that I think is very interesting, and I throw this out as the supreme irony, don't you find it interesting that Jane Fonda was cast as Nancy Reagan in the movie The Butler?
Well, how about if we don't go there for now? But
well, that ties in the Hanoi Hilton story with everything else. And my apologies for my cell phone.
Jeffrey, thank you so much again for joining us. And let's go to Tom now, who's been waiting in Meredith. Hi, Tom. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, I was listening to the part about people coming home. And it struck a chord with me. I served in Vietnam from October of 69 to August of 1970. And, you know, the big thing that hit me is as we went over as individuals, I knew nobody on the plane that I was on. And the same happened when I came home. I literally went from the jungle one day to landing in Fort Lewis, Washington about 2 in the morning, being woken up about 7, went to the pay office, got my last check or last payroll in cash, and walked out the door, and that was it. And didn't ever have a chance to talk to anybody I served with or any you know, because of everything that people have talked about, the anti-war sentiment that was in the country, which led over to anti-soldier sentiment, really. And so you didn't mention to anybody that you had served. You didn't talk about it. You weren't in touch with anybody you'd served with. It wasn't until really the internet in the middle 90s that I and I think a lot of us finally were able to get in touch with these people we had served with. And, you know, when you were dealing with it every day, even though there were incredible things that happened that people did for you, you never had a chance to acknowledge that at the time, because you never knew when the next day was going to be worse than the one you served. And I think that's one of the things that's been the hardest is that that we were just kind of left to fend for ourselves when we got home, and there was no sense of completion, no way to connect.
Now, you had to kind of connect and process on your own, Tom, right?
Exactly, and there was really, you know, no one to talk to. I remember one time I had somebody come in to put linoleum on a floor in my kitchen, and I found out he was a vet. And I remember how great it felt. We didn't talk that much, but I just sat there while he did the floor, and there was a sense of connection that I hadn't had with anybody else, because, you know, there was nobody else that understood the complexity of what you go through in a combat situation, and it was just so relaxing. I that's not the word I'm looking for. Satisfying. There was just a sense of contentment to be with somebody who you felt understood, and that was just, you know, that was so rare. Like I said, that was one incident I can think of in 25 years before, like I said, I started to get in touch with some of the guys.
Connecting with people online and so forth. Tom, thank you very much for sharing your stories with us. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
And you can join us as well in just a moment, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Coming up, a lot more stories from Dartmouth, veterans of the Vietnam War. Stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the latest research on the causes and consequences of poverty in America. Then, how one family used Disney characters to connect with an autistic son. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather mostly cloudy for today with some showers likely and a slight chance of thunderstorms this afternoon. Today's highs mid-60s to lower 70s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from the Altus Investment Group in Concord, helping individuals in central New Hampshire manage their old 401ks and develop a personal retirement plan online at altusinvest.com. And from Revision Energy in Exeter, a local business specializing in the design, installation, and service of solar energy systems. More information online at revisionenergy.com. 940, this is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, controversy and concern over the new painkiller Zohydro across New England. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour on The Exchange, the stories of Vietnam veterans from Dartmouth's Class of 64, now compiled in a new book called Dartmouth Veterans, Vietnam Perspectives, edited by Philip Schaefer. Mr. Schaefer is with us, along with three veterans from that Dartmouth Class of 64, David Kruger, David Hess, and Lee Chilcote. And let's hear from you, too. The exchange number 1-800 892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, we've talked about a couple of the big themes from this war, how it came about, how the public felt about it, how veterans were received. There was another theme, though, that I wanted to ask you about, Lee Chilcote, because it relates directly to your experience. We often hear that Vietnam was unconventional warfare against an unconventional enemy, and that the U.S. wasn't used to that, and that that was part of the problem. How accurate is that portrayal, that this was kind of guerrilla warfare that we weren't at first very good at?
Pretty accurate. We were trained in World War II style, Korean style. I know that when I was with the 25th Marines just on the way over to Vietnam, I was given a manual by Che Guevara, who was a guerrilla fighter in Bolivia, as a guide to teach my troops live fire training and guerrilla warfare. I turned to my major and said, I have no idea. I've not read this. We've not been taught anything. He said, just go do it, Lieutenant. And we did. And so we learned trial by fire, literally.
So here you are, an American Marine studying the tactics of Che Guevara.
Yeah, which was one of the most vicious guerrilla fighters in the world's history. So it's somewhat ironic.
Can you give us a sense, Lee, please, of what that was like to sort of go in trying to apply these different tactics, these un-World War II or Korea tactics, against an enemy that was all about guerrilla warfare? I mean, what did that mean for you kind of on the ground?
Well, we didn't, at the time, we didn't really understand our enemy at all, and nor did any of our commanders. But you look back, and they were well-trained all the way from Ho Chi Minh down to the lowest fighting man. And what we had to do was to learn as we went along. And in some cases, we would try to befriend a Vietnamese to try to learn enough on the ground that we could avoid getting ambushed every time we went out. And that's, it was difficult. It was very difficult. When I see the Iraq and Afghan veterans and see the training they have and read books like One Bullet Away by our Dartmouth graduate friend, it just amazes me how much more they know. But we just worked hard to, one, stay alive and protect our buddies and do what we were told.
Yeah, and some of the stories that you have, Lee, in your essay do remind me of stories I've heard from Iraq and Afghanistan veterans still about, you know, everywhere you turn there's an IED and you don't know where to put your next footstep. Phil, please jump in. Yeah.
There's a historical comparison, an irony, that in Vietnam we were fighting the guerrillas. At our Revolutionary War with the British, we were the guerrillas. And we figured out how to win that one. And this next one, we forgot what we had known.
Yeah, some 200 and whatever years later. Well, again, your comments and questions are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Richard's waiting in Bedford. Hi, Richard. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, ma'am. Just for the record, I was in Vietnam for 2 years, from 65 through 67.
That's a long time, Richard. Yeah.
And been back twice since then. And while I was there, I've been back in 2004, 2007, and I speak fluent Vietnamese. The only reason I called is a fascinating program, and well done by the boys from Dartmouth. But someone made a definitive statement that if we had better military leadership, we could have won the war. I think that history and historians and scholars will agree that we had no chance ever. We had less chance than the French, and they had no chance, and we had less than no chance. And final thing, we lost 58,000 people in Vietnam, and the country was torn apart. The Vietnamese lost 2 million, and they had another 2 million to go. And Ho Chi Minh was far, General Yap was far better than the military leadership we had. So I guess I'll hang up, but I just want to get the panel's comment on whether there was, I maintain there was zero chance to win the war.
Okay, Richard, thank you very much. David Kruger, how about you first?
I must admit that I agree with that caller. In retrospect, although we had massive firepower, we had technology, we did not have the long-term staying power that the other side had. They were going to win eventually, no matter what.
And how do you process that when you get back? Like, wow, I was sent into a war that I now see or feel was unwinnable. I know David Hess has a different opinion, but how do you process that?
I still have no problem in the year I spent there. I believe that I, along with most of the rest of us, if not all of the rest of us, we were good soldiers in a bad war. That said, I've now been back four times and have met extensively with Vietnamese of all stripes and have a much better understanding as to what then was driving them and drives them now. It is very Confucian, and we do not understand the East.
Well, and that's a really interesting point that I want to ask you guys about for sure before we close out, that maybe going to Vietnam as many times as you have, David, has helped you work through some of this.
It's no longer working through. I do firmly believe I'm beyond it. I'm doing it because I enjoy it, because I enjoy the people. I particularly like the cuisine, which as much as I like Chinese, Vietnamese is better.
Well, they had that French influence. So.
No, this is no.
It no.
Is the French only for the croissant. The Vietnamese have come to terms with the American war, which is what they call it, so much better than we have. And the sooner that we get around to understanding that, I believe the better, because it is a good country that despite, as the caller said, they lost 2 million people to our 50-some-odd thousand. And he's right. They would have sacrificed another 2 million and another 2 million after that to win for them a nationalist war, not a communist war.
David Hess, please.
Well, number one, I totally agree with David. The will of the Vietnamese people to succeed in that war far exceeded our staying power. Democracies are notoriously poor at fighting wars of any duration with casualty figures of that amount. I just want to comment on this. My visit to Vietnam in 2009, we spent 3 weeks in Vietnam from Can Tho down in the heart of the Delta all the way up to Dien Bien Phu. And I had we always travel alone. We don't travel in groups. And I had four separate guides in different parts of the country. My guide in Saigon, and by the way, they all call it Saigon. It's not Ho Chi Minh City. It's Saigon to the Saigonese, was the daughter of a contractor for the ARVN and the U.S. military during the Vietnamese War. She was strongly pro-American. We had a kid up in Dalat who was pro-American. We had somebody in Nha Trang and Way and Da Nang and his father had gone through a re-indoctrination camp and was killed in the Chinese camps, Vietnamese camps immediately following the war because he was pro-American. And then in Hanoi and in the North Vietnam, we had the son of a secretary to Ho Chi Minh, who obviously was ardently communist at one point. But every one of those people loved us. Every one of those people couldn't do enough for Americans. And the single question I kept getting over 3 weeks was, are you going to be with us when the Chinese come?
What do you mean by that?
Well, if you go historically, the Vietnamese and the Chinese have a hate relationship. The Vietnamese are, particularly the North, are a very aggressive warrior class. They go back 800, 1,000 years. And Chinese military expansionism has always tended to push down the Indo-Chinese peninsula. So the Vietnamese and the Chinese have a history that runs over a millennium of hatred. And as a matter of fact, within 4 years after we got out of South Vietnam, the Chinese actually attacked the North Vietnamese along the border and killed about 4,000 or 5,000 North Vietnamese in a little, quote, border skirmish.
Yeah, well, and the stories that you both tell about returning to Vietnam, it's great, the welcome, you love it. You've both been back multiple times. And Lee Chilcote, as I understand, you have not been back. Is that a conscious decision or just no time?
Well, as I said, I chose not to go back, and I'm not sure I would today. I appreciate all of the sentiments about the about what a great place Vietnam is. It was a beautiful country, and I've got wonderful photographs and positive memories as well. But I probably would choose not to go back, but rather support Iraqi and Afghan veterans here is where I put my energy, because I find that very helpful.
Yeah, and Phil, I want to ask you about that in just a minute, because there is a, an essay from an Iraqi veteran at the end of your book. But, gentlemen, we talked earlier about, again, that reaction that some of the veterans got when they returned. Not all of them, as we heard from you. And I've got a bunch of emails here from people responding to that, so I just want to share these with you. This is Liz. She says, amazing show. She says, I remember that the military also turned against our guys, issuing out dishonorable discharges to guys just back who weren't all spit shiny on bases. It seemed just to get rid of them. She says also protesters, those who weren't horrendously unsupportive to individual GIs, weren't all there in sit-ins, etc., because they didn't want to be drafted. They were seeing funerals in their hometowns of their friends who were drafted against their wills for a war that hadn't any meaning that justified the loss anymore, if ever. Liz says, hats off to your panel and welcome home. Here's another one. This is from Will. He says, I was a small part of the radical left in the 60s and 70s. I was and am strongly against the Vietnam War, attended many protests, but I want to say as strongly as I can that neither I nor anyone I knew disrespected the vets. They did what our government asked and deserve respect. It was our government whom I felt was making a mistake. I know the vets were disrespected toward the end, and I was opposed to that as I was to the war originally. It might be an interesting story in itself to see where all that came from. Will says it wasn't me. So that's an important point, Will. Not every person protesting the war was, you know, spitting on veterans, as the saying goes. And here's a moving one from Wayne, who says, it is one of the greatest sadnesses in life to have been one of those people who equated our warriors within the war. While I did not engage in some of the awful acts described, I was actively engaged in the efforts to stop the war. Wayne says, I want to personally apologize to you, to those you have on today, and to all those who served so valiantly and were so unappreciated by those of us doing what we saw as our duty, underlined, at home. Wayne says, I will be eternally sorry for my part in that. All of you, Wayne, Will, Liz, thank you for sharing that. And we're clearly, I don't know, Phil, we're tapping into something here. Do you want to go there or not? No. David Krueger?
I appreciate the sentiment. It makes me feel a lot better.
How about you, Lee Chilcote?
Well, I think if you look back historically, and a lot of wars have not been worn well on the public when they were fought, Korea being a good example, and to some extent our own Revolutionary War. The veterans were not universally welcomed at first, but over time, perspective grows. And I actually think the Afghan wars, Iraqi wars, as horrible as they are helping people recognize and differentiate between the role of veterans and the role of our civilian leaders. And I think that's critical to understanding a war and giving it perspective. And I think that is occurring, albeit nearly 45, 50 years out, at least it's occurring.
Phil?
Yeah, I think that the one thing that we really did learn from Vietnam, and I think that there are many things we could have but did not, but the one thing that we did learn as a society was to respect the warriors, for they were just doing what the political force of the nation wanted done. And they were not involved with the decision, and they deserve a lot more support than they were given after Vietnam. And they deserve more support than they are being given now, though it is much better than it was at the time.
You know, Phil, the book includes an essay from a Dartmouth veteran of the Iraq War, a young man, William Peters, class of 2015. Why did you include this?
Well, actually, we had offered. There are about 15 Iraq-Afghanistan vets on campus at the present time, thanks to the work of President Emeritus James Wright. And we offered to that group the opportunity to write essays about their experiences and create a separate section of our book dedicated to them for what appears to be this current generation's Vietnam. And of those 15 students, only one, Bill Peters, was able to write. I think you can understand that when you're too close to the experience, you may not have the perspective or the comfort to be able to write about your experiences. It takes time for some people. Bill obviously was able to do it much quicker than the rest of his cohort.
Lee, you mentioned this earlier, so I'll ask you, what's the connection between your generation of Vietnam veterans and these young veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, it's amazing to realize that the feelings of war, the experiences of war, don't change from war to war in some respects. And I suppose it's the common bond that develops. I've really become pretty close to some of the Afghan-Iraqi veterans. I've tried to help them find jobs and with educational opportunities. And it's very reassuring to receive that from them. And from them, there's kind of a mutual bond and a brotherhood.
Yeah. David Kruger, any thoughts there?
I applaud, Lee, what you're doing. I wish I'd thought of it, and it's something that I will look at even in New Hampshire.
All right. All of you, this has been just wonderful. I really appreciate you all coming in, sharing your stories. Phil, good luck with the book, and it was good to have you here.
My pleasure.
That's Phil Schaefer, 1964 Dartmouth alumnus, editor of Dartmouth Veterans, Vietnam Perspectives. Lee Chilcote, thank you also for taking time out for us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Lee Chilcote. He served as a Marine captain in Vietnam, joining us today from his home in Cleveland, Ohio. David Kruger, it was good to meet you. Thank you for being here and sharing your stories.
Thank you.
That's David Kruger, Vietnam veteran, Dartmouth alum, again from that class of 64 from Exeter, New Hampshire. And David Hess, thank you also for your time. Always appreciated.
The call-ins were very interesting.
David Hess, he's another Dartmouth veteran featured in the book, a 12-term Republican state rep from Hooksett. And his essay is included in the book as well. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, concerns and controversy over the new potent painkiller Zohydro. The FDA has approved this drug, but across New England, there's worry that it will only add fuel to the fire of the region's opiate addiction problem. Lawmakers, governors, healthcare leaders are all weighing in with different ideas about how to avoid abuse and yet still help those patients in pain. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from Royalty Automotive, Volvo specialist for over 15 years, dedicated exclusively to the care and repair of Volvos, located in Barrington and online at royaltyautomotive.com, and Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, Electric. Tune-ups, repairs, and efficient air conditioning systems, including ductless AC for homes without ductwork, online at justcallheritage.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. A half century ago, President Lyndon Johnson declared war on poverty. Since then, the percentage of poor Americans has declined, but more than 46 million still live below the poverty line today. That's about 15% of the population.